finding it hard to talk. I would miss you, too. It's good to... I mean, I do know what I will do. I'll train another monkey to replace you, but damn, what a pain in the ass that will be. Skippy, I shook my head ruefully. Can you save your heartwarming motivational talk for after I'm aboard the Dutchman? I'm gonna be kinda busy. I was flying feet first behind the lead condor, being literally jerked around at the end of a cable that was attached to my legs. Because I needed to see and grab hold of the nose gear of the trailing ship, I had to be facing backwards. The only way I could steer was with my arms. It was like skydiving backwards. To make the experience extra super-duper fun and easy for everyone, Reed's condor was now sinking at 300 meters per second, and that rate was accelerating. At the controls of our ship, Porter had to match Reed's sink rate. He also had to fly above her altitude, with my weight making the cable droop down. Porter also had to adjust to turbulence and try to think how an up or downdraft would affect the trailing ship. For her part, Reed could not simply watch the lead ship and adjust. She had to anticipate Porter's moves. All I had to do was get whipped around on the end of a cable, find Reed's condor, bang into it without killing myself, and loop the cable around the front landing gear. If you want to visualize what I was doing, rent one of the airport disaster movies. I think it was Airport 75, or maybe Airport 78, whatever. It's the one with the actor who played Jesus in an old movie. No, that's not right. Maybe he played John the Baptist. I know it wasn't John the Methodist or John the Presbyterian. Wait, I got it. He played Moses. I remember that because we were living in Boston when that movie came on TV, and during the scene when Moses parts the Red Sea, my father said that if Moses wanted a real challenge, he could try parting Boston traffic during rush hour. Anyway, in that airport movie, the actor needs to go from an airplane into a big jetliner to fly it, because the pilots of the jetliner are dead. He is dangling on the end of a cable, and he somehow has to fit through a broken windshield. He gets his legs in, and the flight attendants pull him into the cockpit. My point is, that guy had it easy. It was a clear day, so he could see what he was doing, whereas I was flying through clouds of hydrogen sulfide and other nasty toxic stuff, and I couldn't see a damn thing without the synthetic vision provided by my suit sensors. He had help, while I was by myself. Also, the aircraft I was trying to hook onto wasn't flying nice and level on autopilot. It was sinking at an increasing rate. The force of gravity on me was 17% greater than on Earth, and the lower we dropped, the greater the effect of gravity would be. Okay, yes, you there, Mr. Nerdface, in the back with your hand up, because you are so smart, I know that before the gravity becomes a big problem, we would have fallen so deep the atmospheric pressure would crush the condor, but the extra gravity was already making it more difficult for me to judge my aim. Imagine you are shooting free throws in gravity that is 17% higher than normal. You have probably shot thousands of free throws in normal gravity, and your eye-hand coordination, your reflexes, and your muscle memory are all set up for normal gravity. Suddenly, you have to put a bit more effort into shooting the ball, and the arc it follows is steeper than you expected. It was like that, as I awkwardly tried to steer myself at the end of the cable. My first attempt to contact the target was almost a disaster. I came in from the right, overcorrected, and was about to smack into the hull hard enough to dent it and kill me. Fortunately for me, the crew aboard the lead condor recognized the danger and reeled in the cable enough for me to zip past the nose so fast it was a blur. "Sorry," I called out as I tried to swing back to the center. "No problem, Colonel," Reed assured me. "Take your time out there." "Thanks, not too much time, sir." "Affirmative." After my near disaster, we kept the cables short enough that I couldn't hit anything, and I concentrated on keeping myself centered. The 12th attempt was going well enough for me to call for more cable. I was below and in front of the target, and we had gotten lucky with the turbulence. The air was smooth. I had gotten better at free-flying on the end of the cable. We tried letting out the cable so I could slip under the condor's nose. It was tricky because the air pattern close to the ship was different and it pushed me away. "Okay, I know how to do it now," I advised after the crew retracted the cable again. For the first time since I stumbled out the back ramp of my condor, I was confident this crazy scheme might actually work. Until then, truthfully, I had launched this rescue operation more because I felt we had to do something than expecting we could save the crew of that crippled ship. "Next time, let the cable out." The trailing condor dropped like a rock in front of me, sinking so quickly it was now below me. Read what happened. Read. Joe, Skippy's voice broke in. Lieutenant Reed is extremely busy. She just lost 3 more fan blades and vibration in the turbine was so bad she had to reduce throttle to 12%. No, now she has gone to 7%. 7? Well, shit, that's practically idling. Reed's Condor had sunk almost below range of my suit's sensors, and my synthetic vision switched over to a feed from the lead ship. Porter, follow her. We can't lose her. Colonel, this is problematic, Porter responded, and I could feel myself dropping faster. The target is now falling in 1,900 meters per minute. The air resistance on you prevents you from falling that fast. Shit. He was right, I hadn't thought of that. At the end of the cable, I was now above the lead condor, and it was sinking faster than I was. Screw this, I muttered to myself. I had been flying in a belly-down position. Now I tucked into a head-down posture, my speed picking up rapidly, and soon I was at the level of the lead ship, then dropping below again. More cable, I ordered. Joe, while this is a heroic action, nothing heroic about it, Skippy. I can always get reeled back in and fly safely up to the Dutchman. My point, dum-dum, is that the only way you can fall quickly enough to catch Reed's ship is to fly in head-down position. In that position, you can't fly under her ship and contact the landing gear. Shit. Double shit. He was right. I hadn't thought of that either. Damn, I was a total freaking moron. What the hell was wrong with me? Why couldn't I think ahead and... Reed! Fireball! Here, Colonel. The turbine is tearing itself apart. I can't... I know. Invert. Fly upside down. There was the slightest hesitation, then a surprised, Sir? I'm coming in above you and I can't get to the landing gear from here, so flip over. Oh, got it. This thing won't fall any faster upside down. She did it. Porter, I need... Doing it now, Colonel, he answered before I could finish because he had excellent situational awareness and knew what I planned to do. Sink rate is now 2,300 meters per minute. Crap. In the thick air, I had trouble plummeting that fast, even tucked in a head-down position. The belly of the upside-down condor approached with agonizing slowness while I fretted I was too late. Then it loomed in front of me, and I had to frantically roll upright onto my belly and spread my arms to slow down. In my third consecutive dumbass move, I had failed to consider the falling condor would create a pocket of air above it. When I fell into that shadow, I dropped like a rock. Nothing I could do could slow me down quickly enough. I belly-flopped onto the condor's belly and hit hard, my suit absorbing much of the shock with airbags inflating inside to keep me from being knocked unconscious. I'm okay. I'm okay, I wheezed, out of breath. The rebound had me hitting again, and I was sliding down over the side, flailing my arms and legs to stop my fall. Listen. Okay, yes, it was pure luck that one of my arms wrapped around the landing gear. I hadn't even seen the thing. But when the cable end automatically looped several times around the gear and the nanofibers basically welded the cable securely in place, there was a triumphant whoop from the lead ship's crew, followed by grateful and excited shouting from Reed and her crew. You did it. Colonel, you did it. Thank you, thank you, thank you, Reed gushed. Hey, no way could I tell anyone it was an accident that I accomplished the mission, right? And no problem, Reed, anytime. Porter, you got her? Cable is secure, Colonel. But now we have another problem. The computer is telling me that to tow the other ship, I need an airspeed that will overstress the cable and cause it to snap. Breaking my dumbass pattern, I had an answer to that dilemma. Forget airspeed, Porter. Both the condors are empty. Your thrust-to-weight ratio is plenty for a pure vertical ascent, even carrying another ship. Reduce your airspeed and lift us straight up. When we clear the atmosphere, you can flatten our course and build up speed to get us into a stable orbit. Sir, that's not... Skippy broke in again. Captain Porter, Joe is correct. The pilot's operating handbook for the Condor will tell you that maneuver is impossible because the Theranin who programmed the flight control system never considered a wild-ass stunt like this, but it can be done. I just uploaded new software into your computer. Huh, was all Porter said in response. Apparently, the Theranin who designed that dropship never met an ignorant monkey. Skippy chuckled. Colonel, I am ashamed I didn't think of that, Porter apologized. Don't be, I replied as I felt the condor I was attached to slowing, with the cable going taut. Our rate of descent was being canceled. When I started flight training, Major Desai told me my best asset was my total lack of experience. I had no ingrained habits to unlearn. You naturally think of lift in terms of airspeed.
Yes, sir, Porter agreed. But I won't do that again. Rate of descent is now zero. Commencing climb.
With Reed's Condor dangling from its nose on the end of a cable, she had to use thrusters to stop us from spinning like a top. We were climbing, and at first all was going according to plan. Then, as our rate of climb increased, I started getting bashed against the hull. It was getting rough.
Hey, Porter, I appreciate the enthusiasm, but slow down. I'm getting tenderized here.
Colonel, we don't have the fuel for that. If I go any slower, we won't make orbit. I can't fly vertically all the way up, he announced.
Shit, I grunted from a particularly hard rap against the Condor's belly.
This is a problem.
Joe, Skippy's voice sounded worried.
Captain Porter is correct. The fuel state is growing critical. Climbing at such a steep angle is consuming fuel rapidly.
If we don't slow down, I bashed my helmet again and was seeing stars in my vision. I'm going to be in very big trouble out here.
Joe, Skippy scolded me. I am very disappointed in you. You rescued Lieutenant Reed's crew, but now your life is in danger because of a little breeze?
It is not a little breeze, Skippy.
Reed made a suggestion.
If I open a side door, could you get to it?
No way, I reported unhappily.
It is too far.
Sir,
she asked after I was silent for a long moment.
Give me a minute here, I'm thinking.
Hey, open your main landing gear doors, Reed.
Good idea, sir,
she agreed with enthusiasm.
It was not easy getting to one of the main landing gear because the airstream wanted to keep me in the center of the Condor's belly, but Reed helped by skillfully and gently tilting her Condor by using thrusters, keeping a watchful eye. She did not overstress the cable. With her help, I slid back and grabbed onto one of the sturdy main landing gear, then tucked myself into the bay where the gear normally rested in flight.
I'm in. Let's be clear about something, Fireball. Do not retract this landing gear. Understood?
With me mostly protected from the screeching airstream, we climbed out of the atmosphere and into a low orbit. Once there, the crew and I transferred to Porter's ship, and I made a quick decision to discard the damaged Condor. We could have tried bringing the Dutchman down to rendezvous with us, but at low altitude, she could not jump away in case we got ambushed, and the crippled ship would have struggled to get into a docking bay on thrusters alone. So we remotely fired nose thrusters to slow it down, and by the time we were safely aboard our fine ship, the broken Condor was burning up in the thick atmosphere. The fuel collection op ended with the Dutchman's tanks only 63% full, and that worried me. But it was enough to get us to Earth with a comfortable reserve. So, we considered ourselves lucky to escape without loss of life, and jumped away to our next dangerous adventure.
Chapter 29.
A jump into the Paradise system was interesting. And by interesting, I mean batshit crazy. Once we got deep into the star system, Skippy could retake control of the Ruhar sensor network and conceal our presence from the hamster fleet. But we couldn't prevent them from detecting the gamma ray burst of our inbound jump, so we had to get creative. Normally, we would jump in no closer than the system's Oort cloud and travel to Paradise the slow way through normal space. But on this mission, we didn't have time, so we needed to jump directly into the inner system. We had three pieces of luck going for us. First, after the nice, pleasant, habitable planet of Paradise, the next planet outward from the star was a smallish gas giant. This world is a grayish-blue ball of gas like Neptune, but smaller, and the Ruhar name for it was Notol. Because there was a big gas giant farther out in the system, and that gas giant had plenty of moons with useful raw materials like metals, the Ruhar fleet used the big planet as a refueling station, and they were setting up ship servicing facilities there. This meant Notol was not of much use to the fleet, so they did not have any facilities there. The second piece of good luck was at the time we had to jump in, Notol was just over 1 month away from its closest approach to Paradise, while the big gas giant with its refueling station was on the other side of the star. We could jump in on the far side of Notol, and its bulk would shield our gamma rays from being seen by sensors orbiting Paradise. Unfortunately, Skippy knew the Ruhar fleet had a deep space sensor platform farther out from Notol, which happened to be in position to get a clear view of our inbound gamma ray burst. Thus,
the batshit crazy stunt we had to use. Notal has 18 moons, most of them asteroids that got captured by the planet's gravity. Only 4 of those moons were big enough for their own gravity to make them spherical, and our third piece of luck was one of these moons was on the side of Notal toward the deep space sensor platform.
"Are you sure about this, Skippy?" I asked while my hands dug into the armrests of the command chair.
"You checked your math twice? 3 times?"
"I checked the math a billion times, Joe, even though this math is so simple even you could do it."
"Oh, wait, what am I saying? Nothing is that simple. Anywho, I got this, Joe. Trust the awesomeness."
"Has this particular type of awesomeness ever been done before?"
"Ever?"
"Yes, it is not super-duper uncommon, but this is the first time it has ever been attempted by a star carrier that I know of."
2 things, Skippy. You using the word attempted is not making me overflow with confidence. And technically, our rebuilt Frankenship is no longer a star carrier."
"Ooh, okay, Mr. Smarty Pants. If you want to have a technicality throwdown with me, it is on, homeboy. I use the word attempted to be totally open and accurate with you, because no ship like this has ever performed this exact maneuver, so we won't know if it can be done until we try it, you big jerkface. Also, although the Flying Dutchman does not look like a star carrier, with the shortened spine and lack of docking hardpoints, the structure and frame are still very much that of a star carrier. Compared to a real warship, the Dutchman is spindly and flimsy, so that this... Is you making me overflow with confidence?" I asked with a nervous glance at the jump countdown timer. Maybe I should have said strong and robust instead of spindly and flimsy.
"Yeah,
see, that's how you..." "Although me saying that would have been total bullshit," he chuckled. "Considering the frayed layers of used duct tape holding this ship together, flimsy is being generous." "Well, too late for second thoughts now, Joe. Jump in 2, 1. Hold my beer."
Maybe jumping anywhere in our Frankenship was crazy, but the truly batshit part was where we jumped. You have to understand, 2 of Notal's moons were big enough to have thin atmospheres, including the moon we used as cover. The jump Skippy plotted has us emerging inside the upper layer of the moon's atmosphere on the side of the moon facing the planet. The bulk of the planet shielded our gamma ray burst from being seen on Paradise, and the moon concealed us from the deep space sensors. The complication was that deep space sensor platform would have detected gamma rays being reflected off the atmosphere of the planet, which is why we pulled the crazy stunt of coming out of a jump wormhole so close to the moon I could have leaned out an airlock and touched the damn thing.
"Skippy,"
I grunted from being flung forward against the straps as the very un-aerodynamic Flying Dutchman bored a hole through the thin clouds of nitrogen and sulfur dioxide. Before we jumped, we had accelerated the ship to beyond the escape velocity of the moon, so even if our engines failed, we could coast through the thin upper atmosphere and safely away from the rocky surface. Emerging into the air, the ship's forward hull slammed into it like a brick wall. Star carriers were not designed to operate in the gravity well of a star system, and they sure as hell were never intended to fly like a gosh darn dropship. Skippy had the forward defense shields on full power, and still there were parts flaking and peeling off the front part of the ship. My original thought was to have the ship come out of the jump flying backwards, since jump physics didn't care about the ship's orientation in relation to the event horizon. But Skippy convinced me most of the critical systems aboard the ship were in the aft section. If we sustained significant damage to the forward hull, that might make living aboard the ship uncomfortable for meat sacks, but we could still generate power, fly, and jump. If the aft section were damaged, it might be adios muchachos for all of us.
"Woohoo! Ride 'em, cowboy!" The beer can whooped excitedly. "Yeehaw!"
"Sir, we've lost several of the portside nose thrusters," Desai warned. "She's turning, and we can't stop the yaw. If she turns sideways to the airstream," Porter added from the co-pilot couch.
"Yeah, yeah, don't get so excited," Skippy huffed. "Adjusting shields to compensate." "We're good. The revised shield configuration is reversing the yaw." "Yep, no problem." "Oh, damn it. There go 2 of the belly nose thrusters. I mean, there they go," he announced as we all felt a bump. "We just kinda lost a section of hull plating. Oh, what the hell, we're almost out of the atmosphere now."
It was a white-knuckle 30 seconds before Desai reported aerodynamic drag was essentially 0.
"We made it, sir." There was a slight flutter to her voice. "Commencing first course correction."
I saw her share a private thumbs up with Porter as they turned the ship to skim the rim of the gas giant planet. Skim, not touch. To gain speed and get the ship turned on course toward paradise, we had to slingshot around Notol, using its gravity well to gain free velocity.
Stealth field status? I asked to anyone who had the data.
It's fine, Joe, Skippy answered peevishly.
Jeez Louise, that info is right on the main display.
No, your supreme assholeness, the main display shows the status of the stealth field generators and the density and shape of the field surrounding the ship. It does not, as you reminded me more than once, indicate how effective our stealth capability is. The ship could be trailing a stream of ionized particles from our passage through the atmosphere, which would point straight toward the ship like a giant neon arrow.
Ugh. Skippy was supremely disgusted.
This is what I get for trying to explain technology to a monkey.
Yes, fine, Mr. Nerdface, you are correct. How the hell did you get so smart?
I didn't mention that Dr. Friedlander had warned me about the possibility of an ion trail after we came out of the atmosphere.
Answer the question, please.
Okay, fine. No, we are not trailing a line of ionized gas. We would be, but I adjusted the shield frequency to de-ionize the gas particles as we passed through, as yet another sterling example of my awesomeness. Our stealth is effective, more effective than any other ship in this backwater star system, that's for sure. Eventually, Ruhar sensors will detect an anomalous disturbance in the moon's atmosphere, but they will attribute it to volcanic activity. Then they will forget about it, because nobody cares. Are you happy now?
Happy enough. Is the first package of missiles ready?
All tubes loaded and ready, Major Sims reported from the CIC.
Launch and reload, then keep going. We need a lot of birds in flight for this op.
Our plan relied on a lot of missiles, but that was okay because we had plenty aboard. We had so many missiles there wasn't enough space in the ship's magazines to store them, so we moved stuff around to empty out cargo bays and stuff missiles in there. Yes, if the ship took a hit to one of those poorly protected cargo bays, the ship would go boom in a big way. But we'd be screwed if we took a direct hit anywhere, so as Skippy said cheerily, there really was no downside. Our surplus of missiles came from the junkyard of shattered ships floating around the Roach Motel. Yes, all these missiles were obsolete, and they didn't all come with fancy options like functional warheads, sensors, and guidance systems. But we didn't always need those. Skippy had been able to cobble together a Frankenstein assortment of parts to create sensors and guidance systems, and for our initial mission in the Paradise system, we did not need warheads. The first volleys of missiles did not need warheads. They only needed speed and stealth for where their explosive charges used to be. They each carried one end of a micro wormhole. The purpose of that first cluster of missiles was to provide remote sensors far from the ship. We knew roughly where the Kristang ship was likely to be, or Skippy had the three most likely locations calculated, but we could not get the Dutchman there fast enough without violating stealth, and we needed to know exactly where that damn ship was. Our missiles could get the micro wormholes in position far more quickly than the ship could have, but they still took a long time to fly to the target area, and then Skippy, the once again magnificent, would have to slowly and painstakingly begin the process of passively scanning a still huge region of space for one small and stealthy ship. While our cloud of missiles flew onward, we had a movie night in the galley. Before the movie, we were showing and mostly laughing at photos people took during our time on Gingerbread. Our time there now seemed to be an idyllic year-long vacation in our rose-colored nostalgia glasses, because we had escaped from the Roach Motel and were hopefully going home soon. Everything was going great, until Skippy began inserting random images that were definitely not from Gingerbread, like the photo from Major Sims' military ID card.
No, don't! Sims implored me, but the image was already there on the screen.
Oh, it's a horrible photo. Oh, crap.
It was a bad picture of her. A terrible picture, but come on. Nobody likes the way they look on a driver's license or ID card. It looked like the photo was taken with a fisheye lens. It made Sims's face look too big and round and her forehead too high. I tried to keep a straight face. Unfortunately, Lauren Poole in the back of the galley slapped the table, unable to control herself.
You look like a potato with a hairpiece.
OMG, I never laughed so hard in my life, and Gunny Adams had trouble catching her breath. Sims's face turned bright red before she also joined in the laughter. People had tears running down their cheeks, and one of the British team fell off his chair. When I was able to speak again, I tried to make up for the insult to our logistics officer. Into my Z-phone, I whispered, "Skippy, pull up the photo from my driver's license." Damn, that picture was awful. I had to sneeze just as the grumpy witch at the DMV took the photo, and she refused to give me a do-over, so my mouth is gaping open, my nose is wrinkled, and my eyes are half-closed. I hated that stupid photo that followed me around the world, and now to the stars. Although, this made me smile while the crowd had a good laugh at my expense, seeing the license photo reminded me that my main driver's license had expired by now. If we ever got back to Earth, I would need to renew my license and get a new photo. That would be my chance. Oh, crap, that wasn't going to work. No matter how careful I was to not look like an idiot when the DMV took my photo, a certain asshole beer can would hack into the system and alter the image. I'd be lucky if I didn't look like a brain-damaged chimpanzee. "Hey, Your Magnificence. Any luck yet?" I asked while stifling a yawn. It was going to be a long night and a long couple of days, even if we did get super lucky. "What? No, you moron. The first 6 micro-wormholes just got into position. I haven't even had time to adjust the sensors for local background solar particle density and radiation levels." "Oh, sorry, Skip. You know how us monkeys can get. Although, something out there is leaking radioactive plasma." "Yep. Bingo, we have a Kristang ship. It passed through recently based on decay of the plasma. Unfortunately, the micro-wormhole that detected the particle trail flew through the trail side to side, so I can't use that micro-wormhole to track the ship. Oh well, I can use it to passively scan for medium-range sensor data and to coordinate the whole squadron. In fact, we are in a bit of luck. The particle density of the trail the ship is leaving behind is so thick I can use a pair of missiles to track it without releasing their micro-wormhole kernels from containment. Bonus, dude!" What Skippy meant was when micro-wormholes were being carried by missiles at high acceleration, that wormhole was only a kernel, a seed of the wormhole Skippy would open. The near end was in one of our cargo bays, with the far end encased in a magnetic force field inside the missile's forward shroud. So long as that magnetic field held the kernel within its boundaries, the missile could maneuver almost at combat acceleration, and the micro-wormhole would remain intact and ready for use. But to activate the micro-wormhole, it needed to be released from containment, expelled from the missile shroud, and expanded. At that point, the missile was discarded, and the micro-wormhole could be moved only very slowly and gently. Skippy could use the wormhole as a real-time sensor platform with no annoyingly slow speed-of-light lag back to the ship. He could send signals through the tiny wormholes, and as we demonstrated in the skies above Newark, we could shoot a maser beam through it. Although transmitting that much power through the space-time wrinkle caused the wormhole to collapse. Our missiles were mostly Theranan gear, with a few from the Giraptha, and even 3 from the wreckage of a Rindaloo starship. Now, if you got excited about us getting access to Rindaloo tech, then prepare to be bitterly disappointed, because those 3 spider missiles were over 800,000 years old, and were obsolete junk, even compared to the obsolete Theranan weapons we recovered from the Roach Motel junkyard. Anyway, it didn't matter much what type of missile we used, because all we needed were their propulsion modules and stealth fields. The motors were pretty much original in most cases, with Skippy performing only minor tweaks, but he seriously upgraded their stealth capability so they were ready for the delicate task they needed to perform. "The ship is where you expected it to be?" I was puzzled while watching the main bridge display. The pair of missiles Skippy had sent weaving back and forth to follow the particle trail left by the unseen ship were now headed away from the cluster of meteors where we thought the ship would be hiding. He had another pair of missiles flying in the opposite direction, flying a wider pattern. The worst part was the Flying Dutchman was close to the meteor cluster, and out of position to intercept the enemy ship. No, the beer can admitted. "That is odd, but not entirely outside the scope of my expectations." "What?" I jabbed a finger at the display. "The particle trail is nowhere close to that meteor shower, and those missiles are getting farther away every second." "Yes, Joe. Duh. The particle trail goes in 2 directions. I have the first pair of missiles flying toward where the trail is denser, and the decay of radioactive elements indicates the particles were expelled from the ship more recently. That end of the trail leads to the ship. The other end tells me where the ship flew in the past, and by data from the other two missiles, I know the ship's course came within 20,000 kilometers of the meteor shower. The ship would have avoided the cluster of meteors because its passage through such a dense cloud of rocks would have compromised the ship's stealth. Ah, crap, I groaned, as Chang expressed the same sentiment in the CIC. The Keepers have already been deployed in aeroshells? Damn it. No way can we capture them now. They'll be spread out all over the freaking sky.
Don't be so hasty, Joe.
Skippy's voice was a soothing tone he rarely used. Yes, it does not make sense for the Krestang to fly close to the meteor cluster more than once, but there are other possibilities to consider. First, there may be more than one enemy ship involved. What? You told us...
I told you what the data indicated. If that data was incomplete, or the Krestang changed their plans, I would not know about that, would I?
He huffed, annoyed at me. This is supposed to be a secret operation by the Krestang. It's not like I was able to get details on their evening news feed, you know. Sorry, Skippy. Joe, the proper time to be sorry is when you get out of bed in the morning and realize you are still an ignorant monkey, not after you say something stupid to piss me off. Nonetheless, as I am humbly generous with my awesomeness, your apology is accepted. Getting back to the subject after you so rudely interrupted me, it is possible the ship whose trail I detected in flying recon to scout ahead for a ship carrying the Keepers. I have other missiles scanning for a second ship now. However, I think it is much more likely there is only a single ship involved, and that it sent out one or more dropships as it approached the meteor cluster. That scenario makes much more sense than the idea of the Krestang devoting more than one ship to this operation. Having more ships involved increases the expense and increases the odds of the Ruhar detecting the Krestang presence in the Paradise system. Also, properly deploying the aeroshells requires the Keepers to already be inside the meteor cluster when they are sent out, and, as I stated, maneuvering a starship inside such a high-density cluster of rocks is tricky. Using dropships makes much more sense. Okay. I exchanged a thumbs up with Chang. I wish you had told us that before, but whatever. Can you scan the meteor cluster for dropships? Doing that now, Joe. Please understand that is a large area generously sprinkled with dust and rocks and other crap, so it is not easy to find one or two stealth dropships in there. Krestang dropships do not use fusion reactors for power, so there is not a nice trail of elements made radioactive by high-energy neutron activation, such as the molten lithium the Krestang typically use as a coolant medium on their smaller ships. Ah, yeah, of course. That's what I was going to say. You know, some other nerdy shit like that. Nerdy? Joe, forget it. You should think of reactor-powered starships as leaving a trail of sparkly magic fairy dust behind them. Since my understanding of fusion power was sadly lacking, I dropped the subject. If it is so super-duper difficult, how do you plan to find any dropships in there? Working on it, Joe, working on it. You could help tremendously by shutting your pie hole for a moment and let the adults handle this. The first pair of missiles is now picking up trace amounts of samarium cobalt that has been embrittled by heavy neutron bombardment, which makes me certain of two things. First, samarium cobalt is used in secondary magnetic plasma containment systems aboard older Krestang ships, so the particle trail is absolutely from a small lizard warship such as a frigate or destroyer. Any larger capital ship would have had its containment system overhauled and upgraded by now. Second, the missiles are getting close enough to the target ship that I can now release one of the micro-wormholes for scanning. I'm going to be busy, so kindly shut up for a minute. When Skippy said close, and then for a minute, I expected he would nail the location of the enemy ship quickly, like within 10 minutes. Instead, it took 47 minutes, during which time I sat quietly, but growing more stressed with every second that passed. Finally, when I was about to go crazy from waiting and doing nothing, the beer can spoke. Got it. That ship is an old mortar-class destroyer. When I say old, I mean the last mortar-class left the shipyard over 500 years ago. Damn, no wonder it is leaving a trail of radioactive particles behind like breadcrumbs. Wait, give me another moment and I will have that ship positively identified. Bingo! It is the final crushing blow to the enemy spirit. We can probably call it the spirit, for short. Great. You said great, but your tone was not as thrilled as it should be, Joe. Skippy sniffed. No doubt miffed that I missed the opportunity to once again praise his magnificent awesomeness. I would be more thrilled if we could simply put a missile up that ship's ass and then jump out of here. Without knowing if the Keepers are still aboard, we can't take any action against that ship, dammit.
It is a frustrating dilemma for sure, Joe. But do you have any suggestions?
Even if we are able to locate dropships in that meteor cloud, we can't hit them either until we know whether they have deployed the Keepers in arrow shells.
Crap, this is getting way too complicated.
I would love to notify the Ruha fleet and let them handle the problem, but we can't give away the secret that humans are flying around in a pirate starship.
I do have an idea, Joe. Sit back, relax, and behold the awesomeness. Or go get some popcorn or coffee or something. It will be a while before we get to the awesomeness part.
A while, in Skippy's estimate, meant more than 5 freaking hours in meat sack time. Okay, sure, what he was doing was a very delicate operation, and we couldn't rush it without revealing our presence and spook the spirit into jumping away. I knew that. I understood that. I also hated it. The awesome thing he did required 2 micro-wormholes. The first one, released from its carrier missile, provided sensor data to Skippy so that he could guide the other missile. He knew roughly where the target ship was, but roughly was a sphere 70,000 kilometers in diameter, and that was way too imprecise for his purpose. He was able to gently steer the micro-wormhole so the search area was between him and the star, which allowed him a good view of the light-bending effect of the enemy stealth field. Once he saw the characteristic ripple distortion of a poor-quality Kristang stealth field, he was able to map the field and estimate its coverage and frequency. The field had several weak points. He programmed the missile to slowly and carefully approach the enemy, tuning the missile's stealth field to match that generated by the spirit. It slid inside the field and would have become lost to us, except, of course, Skippy had the kernel of a micro-wormhole tucked under that missile shroud, so he still had sensor coverage and perfect control of the missile. The beer can expertly tucked our missile between 2 engine nozzles where the Kristang's already crappy proximity sensors were especially blind. Then he proceeded with the actual awesome part. Yes, sneaking a missile up close enough to touch an unsuspecting warship would be considered super bodaciously awesome by anyone else, but by the standards of Skippy, the once again and even more so magnificent, doing that was not even a decent magic trick. Now he had something truly special planned. The spirit had been transported from Camp Alpha by a Bosphorok star carrier, and those bird brains do not possess nanovirus technology like the Theranin. Skippy thought the Bosphorok did not even know about the nanovirus used by their rivals, which was a significant advantage for the little green pinheads. The target ship was infected by nanovirus, but those tiny machines were so old and so degraded, most of them had self-destructed to avoid their decayed components being detected. No way could even Skippy take over the destroyer using a nanovirus, and because the Kristang isolate their control systems to prevent a hostile higher-tech species from remotely seizing control, our beer can was also not able to completely infiltrate the spirit's computers. He was able to project a local field through the micro-wormhole, right against the ship's hull, and disable internal sensors in that small area. He improvised. Our Theranin missiles came equipped with a handy-dandy self-repair kit of insect-like bots and a tightly packed canister of nanomachines. The bots and nano were intended to restore mildly damaged missiles to operation, or to keep missiles combat ready when they were deployed away from their mothership for long periods on blockade duty or other detached assignments. Skippy instructed the bots to activate, leave their storage bins, and each bot took a supply of nanomachines with them as they leapt across the gap between missile and ship's hull. Not even Skippy's magnificence could allow the squadron of bots to simply use an airlock to gain access to the interior of the destroyer, because the Kristang set up their airlocks to at least partly require manual operation. These bots were tiny, like mosquitoes. Even working together, they lacked the size and strength to turn a heavy wheel to crank open an airlock. No problem. Skippy sent the bots scurrying along the hull to a vulnerability the lizards hadn't even considered. It was a small thermal exhaust port, and the bots happily crawled along down the port toward the main reactor. A third of the way down, they stopped to remove a valve, and presto. They were inside. Because that valve had to operate regularly whenever the reactor was pumping out heat, the bots reinstalled the valve behind them under Skippy's direction. Skippy later told me all the amazing things he had his army of bots do, but a lot of it was blah 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 nerdy tech talk that had my brain spinning and my eyes glazing over. Oh crap. Please do not tell Skippy I said that. He thought I was listening intently the whole time while really I was dreaming of making a sandwich. Hey, I had been on duty in the command chair for a long time, and I was hungry. Besides, I'm talking about a supremely delicious sandwich. Thick sliced ham with fresh turkey. Fresh, real turkey, not a thin, suspiciously round disc of processed turkey food product. Whatever the hell that is. A slice of cheddar cheese, not too sharp, but not so bland it gets lost, you know? And you add a bit of horseradish between slices of ham, some honey mustard, or, ooh, even better, maple mustard on the turkey, with sweet roasted peppers. Okay, fine. Back to the subject. Where was I? Ah, no, I'm really hungry. I bet you're hungry now, too. Anyway, Skippy's drafted army of bots creepily crawled throughout that ship, physically plugging into one local system after another. I wish he had been able to do that way back when we boarded and seized the frigate Heavenly Flower of Glorious Victory near Paradise, because our boarding action back then had been a bloody, desperate, chaotic mess. Unfortunately, we had to take the flower quickly that day. That frigate only had a short time to jump in, pick up our stolen Ruha Dodo dropship, and jump away, because a whole lot of Ruha ships were burning to intercept the flower. With the Spirit lazily drifting along in stealth and blissful ignorance, Skippy was able to slowly and painstakingly work his way into every system aboard the ship until he had absolute control of every electronic device within the hull. "And done," he announced, with more weariness than glee. Damn, that was tedious. Tedious! My bots had to keep ducking out of the way to stay hidden from Kristang maintenance and security bots. Wow. 7 hours went by since those bots left the missile. Whew, I am tired. Skippy needs a nap. I'll set an alarm to wake myself. Oh, he yawned. That was a good nap.
You, took like a half-second nap?
Half-second in meat sack time. 4 hours in Skippy time.
Wait, you really took a nap? I thought you never slept.
There were things about Skippy that were different after he killed the worm and rebuilt himself, and I did not yet know everything that had changed. I do not sleep the way monkeys do. What I did was sort of rearranging my sock drawers, tidying up data storage that got cluttered while I was concentrating on the bots. It was very refreshing. Also, I didn't drool on myself the way you do when you sleep. I gave up. There is no point to arguing with a beer can.
Whatever.
Woohoo! I gave him an unenthusiastic verbal slow clap. We have control of that ship. We still don't know where those damned keepers are.
Yes, we do, Joe. I dug that data out of the Spirit's databanks like an hour ago.
An hour ago? Why the hell didn't you tell me about?
Take a chill pill, Joey. The keepers were, as I suspected, loaded aboard 2 dropships that left the ship before it crossed the path of the meteor shower. The ship has a very rough location of the dropships, but those craft were allowed to maneuver independently once they got inside the cluster of meteors. They have maintained strict communication silence and are using stealth technology that is quite advanced for the Kristang. I suspect the Bosphorok loaned some upgrades to them. I have had 4 missiles performing a grid search for the dropships, and estimate 73% of the target area has been cleared so far. The schedule calls for the keepers to be released in their aero shells 16 hours from now. We have... got one. Just detected 1 dropship.
Well, that's got to be one of our targets, unless some other species just happens to be hiding a stealth dropship in that cluster of meteors. Give me a minute. It was 27 minutes, not 1. But I didn't argue with the beer can.
Contact, Skippy exulted.
Got them, right where I expected.
Damn, am I good or am I good?
Scratch that. I am the best, baby.
Who da man? I'm da man.
You are unquestionably da man, Skippy. Please, O greatest of great ones, graciously tell us what the hell it is you found.
Hmm?
Oh, yeah, sorry. Kind of got wrapped up in the moment. A pair of stealth dropships, Joe, tucked inside the cluster of comet debris that will rain down on southern Lemuria as a meteor shower in 3 days. What I do not see are aero shells, which tells me the keepers have not yet deployed. They must still be inside the dropships.
Outstanding.
I clap my hands together happily. That makes for an easier targeting solution. Colonel Chang, lock 2 missiles on...
Whoa! Whoa there, Joe! What are you doing? Skippy interrupted.
I'm gonna blow those idiot keepers to hell, Skippy, and end the threat to Paradise. What the hell else do you think we were looking for them?
Oh, shit. I slap my forehead. Unless hitting them with a missile right now will cause their infected body parts to rain down all over Paradise.
Damn it, I am a moron.
That is a question I should have asked Skippy way before we located those dropships. No, Joe, our missile warheads are sufficiently powerful to turn the contents of those dropships into subatomic particles, although we will need to coordinate their detonation to within a nanosecond of each other. The reason I stopped you is we should not just do the simple dumb guy thing and blow shit up.
Well, I like blowing shit up, Skippy, especially in situations like this. These keeper losers are just begging to get blown up.
Although karma and the universe agree with your assessment of the proper fate for those keeper idiots, it is not that simple. Joe, think for a change, please. The Krestang still possess their research and the pathogen. They can use it later. All they really need to do is threaten to use it later. Humans on Paradise will be treated with suspicion as potential deadly threats until the Ruhar have a vaccine and a cure against the pathogen. I can't develop a vaccine or cure from the data Colonel Perkins collected. There isn't enough detail in that data. We need samples, Joe. Samples and subjects to test my potential cures on.
Ah, crap. We need to take those infected keepers alive? We need to rescue them?
Yes. At least some of them, Joe. More would be better than less, obviously.
Mr. Skippy, Major Smythe asked eagerly, having appeared behind my chair as if by magic.
Damn, did he have a magic trouble predictor that told him when the merry band of pirates would run into a problem that required his help?
Can I assume we need to board and seize two stealth dropships?
Yes, and somehow you need to do it without that destroyer discovering somebody took control of those dropships, or the destroyer could cause trouble for us. We need to keep it quiet until we have full control of both dropships, and we are certain the keepers are aboard and infected so I can get useful samples. Any sort of ruckus out there will attract a dozen Ruhar ships and blow the whole operation.
Sounds like we need a stealthy spaceborne assault.
No amount of British reserve could keep the grin off Smythe's face.
Colonel Bishop, my team will plan the assault, and I will recommend...
No, Major, I cut him off. You can plan a spaceborne assault, but you do not get a vote on whether the op is a go or not.
Sir?
He looked genuinely surprised and maybe a little hurt. I know USAS guys by now. If there is a choice between do crazy shit and not do crazy shit, you will vote for do crazy shit every time.
Oh, he chuckled, relieved to understand I was not actually mad at him.
Ha! Skippy interjected. Joe, with some of the wild stuff you have done, you should not complain about someone else's enthusiasm for nutcase stunts.
Skippy, it may be true that I have a timeshare in Crazy Town, but Major Smythe is the mayor of Crazy Land.
That is why we are out here, Colonel, Smythe observed with dry humor.
If you had wanted tea and crumpets in the parlor, you could have stayed home.
Something like that.
Okay, you can plan an assault, but we'll take it as a given that you are in favor of a go order.
Well, I made a shooing motion with one hand.
Get on with it, then. We don't have much time.
Yes, sir, he replied eagerly, spun crisply on his heels, and strode off down the passageway.
Why do I have the feeling I will very much not like whatever plan he thinks up? I asked to no one in particular.
Skippy answered for me.
Because Major Smythe's plan will not include little Joey tagging along as a mascot. You should stay here, right here, where you can't do any harm.
Not much harm, anyway, because I will be here to keep you out of trouble.
While Smythe's team dreamed up crazy plans, Skippy gathered all the data he could get about those dropships.
Okay. I'm done analyzing both of them. Can't get any more data from out here without alerting the Krestang that someone is watching them.
Outstanding. Can you do your magical creepy bot thing to take over those dropships?
Wait.
I held up a hand. Are all the keepers aboard those two dropships? The Krestang didn't leave a few on the ship to use later, in case something went wrong?
No keepers aboard the ship, Joe. The Krestang have all their eggs in two baskets for this operation.
The answer is no, I can't take control of the dropships the way I did with the ship. The critical systems of a dropship are all inside the cabin, and someone would surely see bots crawling around. Ironically, I can't take control of the dropships because their technology is so crude. That sucks, but it is what it is. There are some minor tricks I can play, but for the major part of the operation, you monkeys will have to do this the hard way.
Ah, crap, I groaned. Major Smythe... I pinged him over the intercom, but his voice came from behind my chair.
"Here, sir," he announced with what to the British might be considered unseemly eagerness. And he was wearing a freshly pressed uniform. It looked like I could slice open my hand on the crease of his trousers. When the hell had he changed into a new uni?
"I suppose now you and your team are up to bat."
The British did not play baseball, but they did play cricket, and up to bat was a term they understood. While Skippy was gathering data about the pair of dropships, Smythe had developed a plan to secure the keepers and bring them back to the Flying Dutchman. "Permission, as you said, to do crazy shit, sir?" His ear-to-ear grin was definitely unseemly, and I was glad to see it. I snapped a salute to him, though we generally dispensed with salutes aboard the ship. "Permission for crazy shit granted, Major, under one condition." "What's that, Colonel?" he asked, a bit of his grin having slipped. "That you do not have too much fun."
"We will do our best to be thoroughly miserable about it, sir."
Chapter 30 Skippy was right. Smythe's assault plan did not include me going with him, and that was not a shock to me. My proper place was in the command chair during an operation, unless for some reason Skippy had needed to go with the assault team and he wanted me along in case he needed a monkey brain idea at the last moment. Major Smythe and his Spec Ops team were suiting up for the operation to board and capture the two stealth dropships that were carrying the infected keepers to paradise, so I went down to the armory to help them get their gear squared away. Okay, no, the team did not need me to do anything. I was really there because I was jealous that I would be stuck aboard the ship while Smythe's team had all the fun. "Hey, Joe," Skippy piped up in the cheery tone that meant he was up to no good. "Ah, crap, Skippy, what is it now?" "You say crap like you assume this has to be something bad," he said in a huff. "Well, you being bubbly and cheery like that is usually a bad sign for me." "Ha! You are so wrong this time, dum-dum. This is nothing but good for you, and really, for the entire galaxy." No way was I getting my hopes up until I knew what he was talking about. "What, did the Maxalt surrender or something like that?"
"Way better than that, Joe."
He was so cheery that for a moment I got my hopes up. Then he crushed my hopes like they had fallen into a neutron star. "I have a whole new batch of show tunes ready for your listening enjoyment."
"That's great, Skippy. Truly. Really great."
I caught the panicked looks from the Spec Ops people around me. But hey, how about you save your batch of bodaciously super-duper new show tunes for the next time I'm in a spacesuit falling into the atmosphere of a gas giant or something?"
"Oh, sure, Joe, because having me sing new show tunes would be a comfort to you at a stressful time when you are facing certain and painful death."
I was thinking that having to listen to your show tunes would make the idea of plunging to death in a gas giant sound like sweet release, but yeah, let's go for the comfort thing."
"Joe, why are you such an asshole?"
"Maybe I was dropped on the head as a child."
"No, I think that's just who you are."
"Okay, smart guy, I was going to treat you to a preview of my latest batch of show tunes."
"What, and now you're not?"
I prepped one hand to exchange a high five with Major Smythe.
"No, I am not. That is your loss." Skippy sniffed.
"Yes." Smythe slapped me five, holding back so he didn't break any bones in my hand. "How did I get so lucky? I was afraid you planned to torture the away team with show tunes during their space dive." "Damn it. I should have known that I had just screwed myself, because the universe hates Joe Bishop."
"Instead," Skippy continued as if I had not spoken, "you can be the guinea pigs as I practice my current obsession, arias."
Oh, shit. My blood ran cold, and Smythe glared at me, looking at his hand as if he wanted to take back the high five.
"Arias? You mean, like, opera?"
"Very good, Joe. I'm actually impressed you know what an aria is."
"Yeah, it's when some guy sounds like he's strangling a cat, and it goes on way too long."
"Ugh," he gave an exasperated sigh. "You are such a cretin, Joe. Here, let me smack you with some culture."
"Please don't."
But it was too late.
"For my first effort, the famous tenor aria from Puccini's opera Turandot, Nessun Dorma, or None Shall Sleep."
He then launched into a tune that I'm sure everyone has heard at some point in their lives, whether they wanted to or not, except most people heard the version sung by Pavarotti, or maybe it was Caruso or whatever, some guy on stage in a dark suit. That was not what we heard from Skippy's awful, screeching, wobbling, off-key rendition.
Nessun dorma, Nessun dorma. Poor Elabridges!
Sir, Smythe looked at me deadly serious.
Whatever you have to do, make it stop.
I'm trying, Major, I responded lamely.
I don't know what...
We have a whole cargo bay full of nukes, Smythe added, and several people nodded. With Smythe's reserved British sense of humor, I didn't know if he was joking or not.
If he won't stop, I'll throw myself at an airlock.
Williams was now glaring at me. I gave him a goofy smile while trying to think. And meanwhile, Skippy continued to torment us, wrapping up to a big dramatic finish.
Tremontate stelle all'alba vincero. Vincero. Vincero!
Then, thank you. Thank you, you have been a wonderful audience. No autographs, please. Oh, thank God, I exploded with relief. It's over. What? Oh, come on, Joe, I was just getting warmed up. Crap, Skippy, if we could weaponize your singing, we could conquer the galaxy in like a week. Please, please, for the love of God, no more opera like that.
Damn, I try to raise your cultural standards and all you give me is grief about it.
Okay, how about some selections from Kristang opera? That made my eyes bulge out of my head.
The Kristang-like opera?
Of course they do, dum-dum. You already knew they love poetry. Those hateful lizards just love their operas, especially the tragic kind, particularly when the tragedy happens to someone else. Hey, here's one that...
Skippy, please, I'm begging you. No lizard opera.
How about Klingon opera?
No, not that either, I hastened to say, not knowing whether he was joking or not.
Joe... This much talent can't be contained forever, Skippy warned.
Oh, bollocks, Smythe sighed.
Mr. Skippy, could you save your remarkable singing talent for the next time we have a prisoner to interrogate, like that Max Hulks?
Sir, he turned to me. Special operations troops are trained to resist interrogation. I know one of the American outfits uses a recording of the poem Boots by Rudyard Kipling, because it is bloody awful and monotonous and goes on forever. It is impossible to ignore. The SAS uses similar tactics, but nothing compares to your beer can singing operas.
I hear you, Major. I felt like a small boy being reprimanded by his schoolmaster, and I noticed he referred to Skippy as my beer can.
Hey, Skippy was insulted. Have you ever heard Joe sing? His voice is terrible.
My voice is not that bad.
Oh, really? The beer can asked with icy sarcasm.
How come you never participate in karaoke night?
Because... Come on, Joe. Sing something for us. Show your incredible talent.
He pissed me off enough that I launched into a song I just made up.
Some enchanted morning, you might see a beer can. You might see a beer can upon a dusty shelf. And somehow you know even then... That you'll regret it, again and again. No one can explain it, Skippy doesn't try. Beer cans are assholes, no point asking why. Once you found Skip, run far away.
My voice cracked on that last part.
Oh, Joe. Skippy's avatar gave me a thoroughly disgusted, ironic, slow clap. That was truly freaking hilarious.
He was being sarcastic, but Smythe's team gave me a thunderous standing ovation and drowned out the beer can. His avatar waved a hand in exasperation.
Oh, shut up!
And the avatar winked out.
Man, if the crew applauded my terrible singing, they really went wild when Skippy disappeared.
Encore! Encore! The crowd shouted.
While Smythe's team were on their long space dive to board and capture the stealth dropships, I had nothing to do, so I was in my office catching up on paperwork. All along, I was supposed to complete crew evaluation reports, and now that we could potentially soon be on our way back to Earth, I had a mountain of forms to fill in. The next one in my stack was Gunnery Sergeant Margaret Adams, and I checked the appropriate boxes at the top. Then I froze. What the hell would I say about Adams? What could I say? Whatever I put in that evaluation file, how could I be sure I was being fair to her,
and being fair to everyone else in the crew. A commander can't play favorites and let his personal feelings affect his. Part of a file caught my eye. It was available only to me, as it was the official assessment by psychologists assigned by Marine Corps and UNAF Command to review her mental and emotional fitness for duty after we returned from our first mission. Another assessment had been conducted after we returned from our second mission.